This is The Takeaway for Friday, May 12th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
So no, I do not believe that healthcare is a basic right.
Folks, you get to ask the questions, and I get to answer them.
Yes, so answer them.
Nobody dies because they don't have access to healthcare.
When are you going to decide to be an American and not a politician?
Around the nation, the emerging healthcare bill is having about as troubled a birth as Obamacare did back in 2010. The lawmaker town meeting has become a tense forum for airing fears and grievances in every quarter of the nation about what's in the bill and what was lost from Obamacare. It's a nationwide phenomenon, and we are going to give you 3 points on the national map to visit.
I was reporting from Cedar Rapids in Iowa.
I was in Willingboro, New Jersey.
Boise, Idaho.
That's Katarina Sestarek, Eastern Iowa reporter for Iowa Public Radio, John O'Connor, correspondent for WNYC, and Frankie Barnhill, reporter for Boise State Public Radio. John followed GOP Representative Tim MacArthur, Katarina witnessed the grilling of Representative Rod Blum, and Frankie watched as Representative Raul Labrador tried to settle his constituents down in a community just outside of Boise.
So actually it was in a suburb of Boise, Meridian, which is a Republican district. And Congressman Raul Labrador definitely has, you know, a lot of ears here. He is in the Freedom Caucus, and he is the only of Idaho's 4 delegates who have held a town hall since the election. But this was a town hall in which there were a lot of people who attended who do not like Raul Labrador and do not like where the Trump administration has gone. And he defended himself. He defended, to a degree, the Trump administration, to loud boos when he was talking about a number of issues, especially around health care and Russia investigations. It was a very ruckus, loud, full event that I attended.
And was there specific demands about health care, specific issues about health care that people told their own stories about?
Yeah, there were a lot of stories, especially Idaho was a state as a Republican stronghold that never expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. And that has left a lot of people, estimated about 78,000 Idahoans, without coverage. They make too much to get the subsidy, but then they also don't make enough to qualify for Medicaid. And so they're left in this gap population. And so a lot of them were there, you know, sharing stories about emergency visits and people they've lost because they didn't have coverage, or people who have suffered in their families who didn't have coverage. And Congressman Labrador, you know, listened to the stories, but every time would say, "Now you're not going to agree with me," and then would launch into his reasoning why he thinks Obamacare should be completely dismantled, why he doesn't think Medicaid should be expanded. And people did not like those answers for the most part.
Nobody dies because they don't have access to health care.
Nobody dies because they don't have access to health care. You got to give Labrador credit. I mean, he really tried to hold his own here.
So no, I do not believe that health care is a basic right. When something is a right, and I think you described it in your question, is something that must be provided by the government.
All right, so his difference of opinion was not appreciated there by the audience. Describe a little bit about this event and where it was.
It was in a large auditorium in a middle school in a suburb of Boise. And yeah, people were there. I think one thing that's definitely happened since the election is that the Democratic base in Idaho, which by all measure, you know, doesn't have that much power, certainly, but people have really become agitated. And that room was almost packed. I think it held about 800 people at least. And he's never seen a town hall like this since his election. He was part of the Tea Party wave in 2010. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a very long night. He stayed longer than the event was planned and answered every single question, which I think people had to give him credit for.
All right, let's move to the heartland and listen to Representative Rod Blum.
If you're currently getting your health insurance through Medicaid, nothing's going to change.
Katarina, he's trying to reassure people there in Cedar Rapids, and he didn't really succeed. Tell me about the event.
Right. So there were over 1,000 people packed into a gym at a community college, and a lot of questions focused on healthcare. And this was sort of a pattern that was repeated multiple times. He listed certain aspects of health insurance and would say, if this is what your health insurance is, nothing's going to change. And people really pushed back on that. They were not having it. A few of the questioners got up there and essentially read specific aspects of the bill to him to show him that some things could change under the bill that was passed in the House. So people were not happy with his assessment of what the bill does.
I would have thought somewhere along the line, somebody would have said that when you impact kids with special needs, we would have thought that maybe we shouldn't be doing that. And so I'm just trying to fathom where that motivation comes from.
Good question. Under the American Health Care Bill, Adam here will not be negatively impacted under this bill. In my book, we should never, ever cut a dollar to somebody like Adam, ever. And I fight.
Now, Katarina, was there good knowledge, high-quality knowledge of what the bill contains? There's a lot of fear there. He's trying to reassure people with facts, and of course, it's not the law of the land yet, so it's a difficult conversation to have. But did the audience have a sophisticated knowledge of this healthcare bill?
They did seem to have a pretty sophisticated knowledge of it. In that clip you just played, the man had his son with him who has a disability, and he was just upset because he felt that the Medicaid benefits that his son received could be rolled back potentially under this bill. And so a lot of people were asking about that. They were telling specific stories about their lives related to healthcare, and they were not happy with Congressman Blum's answers.
Well, Frank and Katarina, you've given us a really strong visual sense of two very tense events with congresspeople who are very directly involved in making this health care bill. Let's go to New Jersey, where we discover, not terribly surprisingly, that the gloves were off.
Is rape considered a pre-existing condition under your amendment? Yes or no? Yes or no? Yes or no? One word, please. One word, please.
Folks, you get to ask the questions, okay, and I get to answer them.
Yes, so answer them. So answer them.
I will.
So, John, is that fairly characteristic of what you observed?
Absolutely. It was as angry a room as I've ever covered during my time as a reporter. Some context that Tom MacArthur is a moderate Republican who basically revived the American Health Care Act when it looked like it was dead. He started talking with conservative members of the House and brokered a compromise. And so folks at this meeting in a Democratic clave in a Republican district really wanted to give him a piece of their mind.
And he tries, again, to reassure and remind people, as you've said, that he's the guy who got people to agree, to really think about actual health care and not just repealing Obamacare. Listen.
Single payer, Medicare for all, means that there's only one party left who gets to decide what doctors get paid. And it works in other small countries, not in countries of this size.
It's so astounding, John, that we're having the discussion of single payer. That's back in the 90s.
Well, I think politically, a lot of folks feel that the backlash to what Republicans are talking about is there'll be a stronger push among Democrats for single payer if they take control of Congress or the presidency again. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction, and the push for single payer is definitely going to be back if Democrats take control.
So Frankie Barnhill in Idaho, did other headlines in the news about the Trump administration make it into your meeting?
Yeah, the Russia investigation was definitely a high point of the entire town hall. People pushing Congressman Labrador repeatedly on it, him exhaustively saying, I've already answered this question, I've already answered this question. In general, there was a lot of ideological challenging back and forth. Since he is a very conservative Tea Party Freedom Caucus member of the House, you know, it was a little bit of lessons about what, you know, he thinks rights are, as he mentioned about healthcare not being a basic right and people not being satisfied with those answers at all.
Katarina Sestarek, how about you? The general headlines in the Trump administration, did they make it into this meeting?
Investigations of collusion with Russia were definitely another thing that people were angry about. The meeting I attended occurred just a couple of hours after FBI Director James Comey was fired by Trump, and that definitely came up. People wanted Congressman Blum to commit to hiring a special prosecutor to look into potential ties between Russia and the Trump campaign, and he said he would not commit to that at this time. He also said that there's no evidence of collusion. People did not want to hear that.
Well, I don't have to ask you this question, John, about New Jersey.
We need an independent prosecutor. We need a bipartisan select committee to investigate this. When are you going to open your eyes? We all see it. You don't see what's going on? You don't see it? When are you going to decide to be an American and not a politician?
So, John, it was certainly a relief for that constituent to say that, but is this more than just kind of talk radio?
I think so. I was a little surprised by the depth of the anger and discontent about the Russia issue from the folks in the room. I mean, as angry as people were about healthcare, they were just as angry about Republicans in Congress seemingly turning a blind eye to what they felt, you know, at least unanswered questions with the president's connection, campaign connections between Russia and the president's campaign. So, yeah, I think it's more than talk radio. I think this is something that voters, you know, will take with them when they step into a ballot box.
Three very vivid windows on what's going on in America right now, and three crack reporters, Katerina Sestarek, Eastern Iowa reporter for Iowa Public Radio, John O'Connor, correspondent for WNYC, taking a look at what's going on in New Jersey and New York, and Frankie Barnhill, reporter for Boise State Public Radio. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this moment of the 21st century, America's slave legacy and racial history and the Confederacy have all abruptly emerged into an active conversation about what is America. Suddenly, in New Orleans, statues to Confederate generals Robert E. Lee, P.G.T. Beauregard, and Confederacy President Jefferson Davis, along with an obelisk marking the Battle of Liberty Place, have reacquired meaning as symbols of hatred and white supremacy. So when an anonymous donor stepped up with money to remove the four monuments and the New Orleans City Council voted 6-1 to proceed, the obelisk commemorating the Battle of Liberty Place was brought down. There was relief in some quarters, but also protests erupted. Then around 3 a.m. just this Wednesday, another monument was taken down. Jefferson Davis, cast in bronze and mounted on granite, pulled down with a crane and crated off to an undisclosed city warehouse. Michael Tisserand is a New Orleanian and the author of Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. He joins me now from WWNO in New Orleans with some thoughts about history being stirred up.
We have such a rich history, and we just completed the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival season here, which reminded us of the great, joyous, integrated art that we've created together here in New Orleans. And then you have these statues declared by the city council as nuisances that really represent a very short time frame following the Civil War, when the sons and daughters and the fans of the Confederacy got together and tried to reclaim, I guess, the last threads of their pride after having lost this battle, and started erecting these monuments. And I believe that Mayor Mitch Lander and the city council rightfully recognize these as relics to a time that don't necessarily need to be cluttering up our most public and visible civic spaces.
And what's the pushback, and who have participated in these protests?
There's been an effort over several mayoral administrations and several generations to better deal with these monuments, especially the Battle of Liberty Place monument, which was erected in 1891, about a battle in 1874, and when the White League forcefully regained control over the city, over the mixed-race city and state police forces. Some of the pushback, some of the real visible, more disruptive pushback you've seen in pictures, certainly has been people coming from other states that seem to want to go to Confederate monument to Confederate monument to protest this thing. Louisiana's open carry, so some of those folks were waving shotguns or automatic rifles around. So it was really disturbing, especially close to public schools. But then there's certainly a local opposition as well. And I know friends of mine, I did not grow up here. I've lived here for about 30 years. friends of mine that did grow up here talk about white friends, talk about seeing these as just beautiful landmarks that make their city distinct. And there is an emotional attachment, especially, I think, to the Robert E. Lee statue in Lee Circle, because that, along with the St. Louis Cathedral or the Superdome, kind of defines our skyline. You just think of it, it's kind of this benign, sort of lovely presence of this guy folding his arms facing the north.
These monuments no longer have a neutrality. They you know, and the Confederate flag is a good example. And this is something that was removed from the State House in South Carolina. And that was perceived ultimately as proper. Is this the same kind of narrative?
I believe so. Certainly that is what Mayor Mitch Landrieu said inspired him. He said that the Charleston church shooting sort of made him take a second look. Also, a conversation with New Orleans-born jazz musician Wynton Marsalis, in which Mayor Landrieu said that conversation kind of opened his eyes to these statues that as a kid he drove past and never really thought too much about. And I have to say, for the longest time, I thought Lee Circle and the big statue of General Lee was sort of a quaint, a historic relic. And not until conversations with black friends in New Orleans did I start to see it through their eyes as well.
Certainly these monuments celebrate the Confederacy. They don't remind us of the blight of slavery and the, you know, the oppression that went on during that war and preceding that war. But is there a danger of forgetting history altogether with the removal of these monuments?
I think we've forgotten history with the erection of these monuments, with the establishment of these monuments. You know, I go to this park, Palmer Park, which is pretty close to my house on the corner of Carrollton and Claiborne. It's a beautiful urban park, and it's been reclaimed by the neighborhood recently, and I go there for crawfish boils, and I go there for an art market every month. And it wasn't until writing this piece that I found out it was named for Benjamin Palmer, who was a minister to the Confederate forces and gave a famous 1860 sermon on Thanksgiving that was credited with inspiring and moving forward the Louisiana secession from the nation. And the sermon was about the Christian duty to preserve and to defend slavery. And in 1902, this was it was Hamilton Square, it was formerly called, was renamed Palmer Park to try to bolster that legacy, to try to bolster the sort of emotional attachment to white supremacy and white dominance that was also being rolled forward in the courts with Plessy versus Ferguson establishing separate but equal and other rollings away of the idea that blacks should be 100% civilian, should have civil rights, should have the rights of all. So I think there's been a great amnesia about the meaning of these statues and these park names and these street names and these school names that's kind of settled over us in New Orleans now, especially over New Orleans whites. And I think a lot of the pushback is sort of a resentment about waking up from this amnesia. What I would love to see, you know, when you go to Birmingham, when you go to Memphis, there's these world-class, really wonderful and incredibly educational civil rights museums. And New Orleans could do that too. We were the leader in the 19th century civil rights movement, again, leading to the Plessy versus Ferguson challenge, in which a lot of the same techniques that were adopted in the 20th century civil rights movement got their start in Treme and in New Orleans. And we were the first black-owned daily newspaper. The New Orleans Tribune was located here. It was such an active time. Abraham Lincoln received two Creoles of color into the White House, who handed him a petition signed by 100 Creoles of color. So we have such a huge history of civil rights, both in the 19th and 20th centuries here, that I would love to see these monuments moved into that type of institution, where they could be seen for what they really are, which is sort of speed bumps on the very rocky road towards civil rights.
Well, thank you so much, and happy Jazz Fest.
Thank you. It just ended, but the jazz continues.
Michael Tisserand, New Orlean, and the author of Crazy George Harriman, A Life in Black and White. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Takeaway culture reporter Melissa Locker says as the ticket to a live event becomes the most valuable commodity in the music business these days, some innovators have begun to experiment with how to make different kinds of live events than just the standard big arena concert. The Red Bull Music Academy is a world-traveling series that takes place over several weeks. It's part showcase for musicians, established and up and coming, part workshop for those looking to collaborate and learn. Think TED Talks meets Woodstock meets a club like The Lash in downtown L.A. Melissa has a tantalizing preview of artists worth checking out, starting with the Prince of Soft Soul himself, Patrick Adams.
I just did a profile of him over at The Guardian, and he is absolutely fascinating. He was a huge, huge person in the disco community, and it's not like the typical cheesy disco that you're used to. This was kind of like underground disco. It's much grittier, much grimier, and it really influenced a lot of like club music today. And then when disco died, he reinvented himself and became one of the most important like hip-hop producers and is involved in some of like, the most important hip-hop albums of all time.
Alice Coltrane is featured also.
She was an incredible composer, a jazz musician, multi-instrumentalist. She basically invented her own genre of music, combining kind of the Detroit gospel music that she grew up with the Indian-influenced kind of music that she fell in love with later in life, combined them into these beautiful experimental cassettes that she put out. And she died a few years ago, and they're finally putting together this incredible tribute album that's coming out in, I think, in a couple of weeks. And before that, they're doing this concert where her son, Ravi Coltrane, and a whole bunch of other people are paying tribute to this woman who has kind of been lost in the shadows.
Well, way past anything I've heard of is GOM.
Honestly, your guess is as good as mine as to how that is pronounced. I've heard GOM, I've heard GQOM, but they're this South African beats music that is really wild, really frenzied, all over the place. Just super fun dance music that is straight out of the streets of South Africa.
There are high-profile artists who are presenting here, or is this really the introduction of a genre?
This is their first time in America ever performing their music here. And it's going to be a whole bunch of producers coming together and just explaining what this is to the world. And I believe this is one of the ones that you can stream online on Red Bull Radio.
The Guggenheim is going to be taken over by part of this festival, right?
Yeah. So the Guggenheim is being taken over by Solange, who, you know, Beyonce's sister, mm-hmm. Solange. And, you know, she had an incredible album last year. Was it like craze in the sky? Sometimes I don't want to feel those little lines. But this time she's not really performing music. She's actually doing an interdisciplinary performance piece, but it's definitely focused on dance and art. And I honestly have no idea what to expect, but I'm really excited to see.
Well, Solange I know, but Zola Jesus and Sacred Bones,
yeah.
Nope.
So Sacred Bones is a record label that has been in Brooklyn and in New York City for about 10 years, and they put out some of the most beautiful, but it's challenging, music. It's bands like, you know, Norwegian artist Jenny Hval, and so this show is going to be marking their 10-year anniversary, and it's just going to be a very crazy evening showcasing everything that Sacred Bones has been doing in the music industry.
And we'll give you a little preview with Zola Jesus's Dangerous Days. Melissa Locker, cultural reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. Thanks, Melissa.
Anytime. Thank you.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about, and that's what you are willing to do for me.
You should reward me accordingly.
Which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
I volunteer as tribute.
Stick with me and we'll claw our way to the top.
Well, there's a first time for everything.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. This weekend, we've got two big movies being released and two small movies being released. Let's start with the big, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. The trailers for this one are maybe even too long.
I see what you're doing. You're trying to get me to do something razzle-dazzle with that sword. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not getting drawn into this mess. And there's an army of you. There's only one of me.
So this is the reluctant Arthur,
That's right. This is the reluctant Arthur. This is also the cheeky guttersnipe Arthur, who was raised as an orphan and didn't know he was the rightful heir to the throne until he pulls Excalibur from the stone. And that's Charlie Hunnam, who plays Arthur. And the important thing to note here is this is a Guy Ritchie film. So this is Guy Ritchie trying to bring a little cheeky attitude, some kind of Cockney-style rascals to the Arthurian legend. I have to say, he tried to do this with Sherlock Holmes, which I think those movies were semi-successful. It just doesn't work. I think this kind of odd mix of comedy and cockiness, along with these very expensive, very operatic set pieces involving monsters and creatures and the Lady of the Lake, it just doesn't sit that well. It's sort of like the movie wants to be taken extremely seriously, except when it doesn't, and it throws you the occasional wink.
Movie number two is Snatched, and the two words I have for you are Amy Schumer.
I want to focus on you and me on the beach. Are you with me?
I can't go to South America.
What are you talking about?
I can't go to Ecuador.
You know it's a non-refundable trip, right? I mean, I don't want to make it about money because money comes and goes, but I don't have any more coming right now. So
I'm breaking up with you.
When?
I gather now.
That's exactly right. That's Randall Park playing Amy Schumer's boyfriend. And of course, she takes her mother, played by Goldie Hawn, on her trip to Ecuador, and they both wind up getting kidnapped and they have to escape their captors. To me, this really should have been a momentous occasion. Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn, a classic film
star.
With Schumer, who's like one of our hottest cultural forces right now, there's just, I think this movie really misses a lot of opportunities to say something about these two women and how they kind of come from these different generations. It's really just a pretty good R-rated, raunchy comedy with some funny moments and some good supporting characters. Wanda Sykes is very funny, but...
So, no sociology. Fine, Rafer. You know, we can handle that. Little movie number one is called The Wall.
Something's not right.
What? Talk to me, man. Talk to me. What's going on down here?
Eyes. They are headshots, man.
The big war movie this summer is going to be Dunkirk, of course. This is not World War II.
What
period is this?
This is the Iraq War, although after the Iraq War, while it's winding down. That's Aaron Taylor Johnson and John Cena, the wrestler, playing two army guys who are basically out in Iraq. They get pinned down by a sniper. Aaron Taylor Johnson's only protection is this very small, crumbling brick wall. He doesn't know where that sniper is, but the sniper knows where he is, and he's talking to him through his earpiece. It works. I would have liked to see it say a little something about the Iraq War, but it does work as a thriller. It's short, 90 minutes, keeps you on the edge of your seat, and so in that sense, it works.
Lowriders.
Nothing happened.
Nothing happened.
It's just a car.
Do you think that's just a car?
Do you know how much heart and soul went into that car, Daniel? That is your heritage. It's priceless.
That's a young actor named Gabriel Chavarria, and Demian Bashir plays his father. He's a graffiti artist. He doesn't really want to go into the lowrider lifestyle and follow in his father's footsteps, so he's kind of having to choose. I really wanted this to be a sort of a landmark film. There aren't that many teen films aimed at Hispanics. It's pretty hokey, and I think the real problem with this film is that it treats us like tourists, telling us what's going on, telling us about lowrider culture. I wish they had just dropped us into it and sort of let us learn the ropes for ourselves, and instead it makes you feel like you're watching something like a reality TV show. You're being guided through the culture instead of living in it.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
All I have in my pocket is a nickel and a nail.
Sometimes you speak to someone who is just the embodiment of joy. Don Bryant is a songwriter and musician. He's a landmark on the strip of roadway between Memphis and Nashville, and if you drive too fast, you might miss him. He's the smiling billboard on Music Highway. Back in the early 1970s, singer-songwriter Don Bryant was churning out hits for High Records, the label of veteran producer Willie Mitchell. Bryant wrote for the likes of Al Green and Otis Clay, and in 1974, Bryant married soul singer Ann Peebles, and the two collaborated to write one of her biggest hits, I Can't Stand the Rain. Now at the age of 75, Bryant is releasing just the second record of his career. The last one came out in 1969. Don't Give Up on Love is out today. But Bryant doesn't think much about dates on a calendar. For him, it's all just one more refrain in a lifelong song.
I just felt that this was going to be me. This music is going to be me. My father was a singer. He was a gospel singer. He had a gospel group, and I guess I inherited it from him. Blues and whatever just grabbed me.
Do you remember the first time you sang Don't Turn Your Back on Me?
Don't turn your back on me. Don't turn your back on me. Now that I need you to stand by me.
Not necessarily the first time, but I thought when I wrote the song, I thought I had such. I would write them, and Willie wouldn't really have to come to me, because as I wrote the songs, I would bring them and present them to him.
You know that deep down in your heart that I am doing the best I can, darling, remember.
He would, most of the time, if somebody needed a song, he would have two or three of my songs already there at the studio that he could present if I wasn't there.
I see. Well, let's take a look at this album here. There's a song called How Do I Get There?
They tell me that the blind will see. And you tell me that the lame walk.
What's How Do I Get There?
How Do I Get There was, I was hadn't been singing, on the road or anything. I had got involved with the church and what have you, and I was singing with the choir or what have you in the church.
Somebody help me, please.
How do I get there?
Tell me, how do I get there?
How do I get there?
Hey, 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 hey.
And questions. About the Word of God is always common. Somebody want to ask some kind of question. These things that I think about, some people might want to know, you know, and you got a lot of people telling them a lot of different things, you know. So asking how do I get there, I mean, that was a situation that came up in my mind. Somebody would be asking that question, and how would you answer them if they asked you that question? And I'm sure everybody had their own opinion of how they would answer.
Don, tell me how you got connected with Ann Peebles, that you weren't just the backup singer.
Well, when Ann came in, you know, and became the main attraction, it was not hard for me to move aside for the main artist of the studio at the time, you know. I just wanted to be a part of what's going on, whether it was writing or whether she needed background voice or what have you.
But didn't you have to do a little solo to ask her to marry you?
Well, that took some time. That took some time. And we started working together. We started writing together. You know, I started traveling with the band, opening up shows and different things. And once you get into writing things, the two of you there sitting up trying to come up with lines and different things, you tell a lot about yourself, you know. And we began to talk, and then found out we had a lot of things in common. We both had large families and different things, you know. We had a lot of things in common. And as time went on, you know, it got closer. We just got closer and closer. And I thought everything was going so beautiful at the time. So, you know, I asked her if she would marry me, you know. Why can't we get married, you know? And she had no objections at the time. So, you know, it didn't just happen right away, you know, but we knew what the next step was going to be because we had talked about it, and we both agreed on it, you know. So
I just learned you wrote I Can't Stand the Rain. I love that song.
Yes, uh-huh, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Man, you and Ann Peebles, right?
Yes, uh-huh. That song came along quite by accident.
Hey, window pane, do you remember how sweet it used to be?
were going out to a show one night, and we were all gathered at my house, and the storm just broke out, and we knew that we wouldn't go be able to leave and go to that show. And somebody, I don't know if it was me or Ann, somebody said, I can't stand this rain. When we heard a line or something that kind of pricked us, we were ready to get to writing on it. And I heard that line, and I said, that's a good title for a song.
Well, Don, I have to say, you are the most optimistic person in the music business I have ever spoken to.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. I've got to be optimistic, you know, because I still feel, hey, there's something ahead for me, and I still love the music now as much as I loved it then. I thank God for the voice, to still have voice, to be able to do it, and, you know, I enjoy myself.
Latest album is Don't Give Up on Love, and Nobody Should Give Up on Don Bryant.
All right, all right. Thank you so much. Hey.
And with a chuckle from Don Bryant, why don't you all have a Don Bryant joyful Mother's Day weekend, huh? We've been asking you, only the takeaway would do this, ask you to describe a photograph of your mom on the radio.
And my name is Marie. I'm from Portland. This is a photo of me and my mom, my second son, shortly after he was born. He's sleeping on my chest, and I'm looking down at him, and my mom is cuddled up to us, and the look in her eye is just pure love.
This is Lori. I'm calling from Oakland, California. The photo is of my mother, Dr. Libby Tanner, when she came to visit me in May of 2011 in California, and we went to Yosemite for a week. My mother grew up in Tennessee and loved the mountains and rivers and lakes, and so she was in her element in this photo from the giant sequoias. 2 months later, she was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic cancer, and a year later, she lost her fight against this horrible disease. Her spirit is with me every day, and I have this photo framed in my living room.
There's an album of all of your photos on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for sharing. Happy Mother's Day, and thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.